So, okay, so this is another online seminar with a guest lecturer. This is Dr. Benjamin Judkins from Cornell University. Dr. Judkins is a political scientist by training, but he works with me as co-editor of the journal Martial Arts Studies. And Ben is an expert on Chinese martial arts and their global spread and their global dissemination. He's written a book called The Creation of Wing Chun, which is about the invention of a Southern Chinese martial arts. And I thought it would be great to speak to Ben today about things around East-West binaries and cultural traditions and so on. So welcome, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Paul.
So yeah, thanks for attending. That's great. We're all under lockdown, and it's all a bit different. But one of the great things about it is that it just brings this in as a possibility. Like, hey, why don't we just, if everyone's using Zoom, why don't we just have guest lecturers in rather than me speaking to myself? So you've had a look at the module handbook, and
I have.
you've read the readings. Is there any, I mean, what leapt out for you? What did it speak to you at all? The themes around East-West binaries and body
Oh,
technology.
absolutely. Right. Yeah, it's critical from so many different perspectives. A lot of the work that I do is in the early 20th century, late 19th century, early 20th century, and we see this very strongly because this is the heyday of nationalism, right? So in the late 19th century, everybody wants to be a nation. After World War I, everyone now sees a pathway to being a nation. But to be accepted as a nation, you had to have a few things, right? You had to have a Volk, you had to have a people, you had to have a homeland, you had to have a literature. So like everyone had epic poetry in the early 20th century. If you ever wonder why the Kalevala and epic poetry got big, this is why. But you had to prove that you had a folk culture. And so we see this explosion of people defining their own body images and their own body cultures in the early 20th century as a way to put themselves on the chessboard of history. And the stunning thing to me is that it just keeps going on over and over and over again. It wasn't just something that popped up once in the, early 20th century. We can see the same thing happening in the 1970s with early globalization. We can see the same thing happening in films that are being made in China and India now, right? It isn't just interesting to think about, how we visualize the world, but go look at how those films visualize us as well. So it's just once you get these basic ideas down, they're really powerful. They're very portable through history.
So you think that the rise of certain national things that we identify with different cultural traditions, like we identify yoga with India and we identify Tai Chi with China, and so and th this is a you think this is some way related to nationalism?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that it's related to nationalism, and to the marketing of national identities, right? The interesting thing about nationalism is it's outward facing and inward facing at the same time. You have to consolidate your population domestically around this notion that there is a nation, right? To quote Benedict Anderson, you got to get everyone to imagine that they're the member of the same community. And that's not necessarily easy, right? Even relatively small countries like France could be just horrendously linguistically and culturally diverse. And it takes a lot of work to get everyone to imagine that they are, the members of the same project. But in a sense, that's the easy bit. Because once you've got people internally imagining that, you then have to turn around and get the entire rest of the globe to accept you as that, to accept you into this growing nascent family of nations, right? And so selling that imagined community becomes huge. And these bodily cultures, I think, were viewed as the royal road to explaining to other people in the globe that, yeah, we have a distinctive culture that's valuable, that is similar enough to what everyone else is doing that we deserve a place at the table, but it's different enough that you can't just fold us in with everybody else. We have to be acknowledged separately, right?
Yeah.
You know, like one of the things about Ben Spatz is that he makes this big differentiation between athleticism and somatic pursuits. But if you actually go back and look at the 1920s and 30s, and I've been doing this quite a bit in my research, it's those differentiations are not always as hard and as fast as he might lead you to believe. So if you look at the 1936 Olympics that happened in Berlin, of course, we have wonderful athletic events. You know, Jesse Owens goes and he does his thing. And clearly there's a big racial element to that and a, you know, a big political element to that. But what we often forget is that some of the most popular events in the 1936 Olympics were not formal medal-bearing events. They were exhibitions of national culture that happened in the evening, where every one of these countries sent huge teams of people out, like dozens or in some cases hundreds of teams of athletes that did nothing except demonstrate their local physical culture traditions. And everybody came. It was packed. It was the most popular part of the Olympic event. And so, you know, like the Indians were out there doing yoga as an exhibition, and the Chinese were doing Tai Chi as an exhibition. And people from Sweden were doing Swedish gymnastics as an exhibition, right? And, you know, we talk about the world stage as a metaphor, but suddenly the world stage was an actual stage with actual press critics on it. And, you know, what they thought about your exhibition of physical culture was about to become very, very important as we transition from the 1930s, which were bad, to the 1940s, which were, you know, horrific.
Okay. I mean, I think with Ben Spatz's, with his work, when I read it, I didn't think that he was saying that there's always a distinction between like somatic bodily practices, things that we engage in just for the feel of them. So like we might do yoga or we might do Tai Chi or we might do Pilates just because they feel great. I mean, we might even just go for a run because it feels great, but then we could do it for the healthism aspect, which is we could do it for the lose weight. We could do it for I read Ben Spatz's arguing that that's quite a recent transformation, so that maybe whereas in the 1930s yoga or Tai Chi or cricket or whatever was regarded as a highly nationalistic kind of piece of PR or a piece of nation building and image building, that more recently everything becomes evaluated in terms of like, will this make me thin and happy? So I mean like that I thought that his argument was that the healthism worldview that we now have, or that maybe we now have, or more and more people have, is quite a new development. I mean, what do you think?
It's hard. New development where and for whom, right? Because I understand why Ben is saying this. And I do think that this is where a whole bunch of critical puzzles in his book come up. Like, he keeps putting, you know, endurance sports like jogging, like, you know, the ultimate endurance sport has no purpose. You just go and do it for as long as possible, right? He keeps putting it in the athletic category. And I'm like, you know, when I jog and all the people I know that we jog, we aren't really looking to set any distance records, right? I don't even know that we're looking to be thinner and healthier. Interesting thing about runners is they aren't all actually thin. And they're not all actually super interested in that. A lot of us jog strictly for the somatic experience of it.
Yeah.
Because we feel better when we do it. It's interesting, or we're localizing that question from, you know, what can the body do to like, what can my body do?
Yeah.
Right. You know, how do I tweak my personal performance? So research with a very small R. So I think that we've honed in on kind of some of the central issues with Spatz's, you know, argument, in that the way people experience these things, and I'm sure he would certainly agree with that if he was here, right? Mm-hmm. is different from the ideal type always of how you would expect people to experience these things. I don't experience jogging as particularly competitive or particularly athletic, right? I think I probably experience it more like what, you know, he was describing as his third yoga school, right? You know, not the second competitive yoga school, but sort of the third yoga school.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Ben Spatz's treatment of the healthism paradigm, I think it's not quite complete, because I think that to complete this, you need to go to the idea of the datafied subject. You know, like we're now data subjects with our Fitbits, which this, you know, this is my act of subversion. Like, I'm not going to wear a Fitbit. I mean, I was telling all the students in the lecture, like, I don't time things. I don't, you know, if I'm lifting, well, it's not strictly true. In the past, I would never count weights. I would never count reps. I would never count, or when it comes to running. But then when I got an iPhone and there was an app on it for like Runkeeper or something like that, then all of a sudden it became completely, all consuming. Like, is this run faster than the last run? And you've got the voice in your headphones going, you know, like, you have done, you know, average speed, and your average speed is going down every mile. You're like, ah. So, and it kind of ruins it, and it kind of takes away the somatic experience of it as a joy or as a hobby or as a way of feeling good, and it transforms it into something else. Like, we're captured as subjects, we're recruited and pulled into this kind of Foucauldian or Deleuzian nightmare of monitoring everything and regulating everything. So I think that Spatz's healthism paradigm is more about the visual image. It's like, it only makes sense if you're losing weight, or only has value if you're getting a six pack, or if you're getting striations in your muscles or veins in your arms or something. You think?
I think the idea of measurement is really critical. And I'm also curious, you know, is like the how far we can push this, right? So there is definitely healthism in the yoga world and in the martial arts world today. I mean, it's the number one reason anyone says that they go into a yoga studio, or the number one reason anyone says that they go into like a, you know, a taekwondo class or anything. I mean, probably any studio-based activity we can imagine is that they want to lose weight and be healthy, and they've kind of conflated those two things, and they have this very distinct visual image of what that looks like. Right. And in the martial arts aspect of it, we can push that back to Bruce Lee, at least. Right. Bruce Lee gives us this revolution in body image for, you know, what a healthy martial artist should look like. You know, and I think Spatz does a good job of problematizing that, you know, asking, wait a second, was that body really healthy? You know, and if these guys are so healthy, why are they so injury prone and always sick? Right? You know, valid questions to ask. But, you know, if you go back and you look at the 1919 Jingwu anniversary book, which is published in Shanghai in 1919, the founders of Jingwu are all wearing honest to God leopard skins to show off like how ripped they are.
Do you want to say, do you want to tell the students what Jingwu is or was?
Okay, so this is a Chinese martial arts association that, you know, existed in the Republican period, so between about 1910, and people say it fell apart in 1926. It kind of like lingered on forever, but, you know, you're dealing with, you know, an organization from the early 1920s, and it was dedicated to teaching martial arts, but a very identifiable healthism was there. Right? You know, they weren't interested in teaching people self-defense. It was a type of healthism. But again, then the question is, well, how is it different? How is it a little bit different from what we've got going on today? And they were big into quantification, again. And they liked bodies that looked like Bruce Lee's bodies. I think a lot of the things that people attribute to Bruce Lee that are as being very innovative is actually kind of Bruce Lee telling us about stuff that had happened in the 1930s that we had just totally missed, right? You know, he knew about things from the 1930s because of his teachers. And when he lays it out in front of Americans, we're like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this. It's like, yeah, well, you know, you weren't in Shanghai in the 1930s. You didn't, you missed it, right? But those guys in the Jingwu Association are all looking like Bruce Lee. The difference is, though, that the goal is not personal health, it's the state, it's national health.
Yeah.
They're imagining different bodies. They aren't imagining a personal body. They imagine personal goals, but they're not the end point, right? They're to get you to something else, right? And if we take it even further back in the Chinese martial arts, I've got, you know, some texts from the 18th century that are talking about how great martial arts training is because it allows you to be fitter and healthier, right? So it is definitely kind of healthism. These are kind of elite people that are writing, obviously. So they're not so worried about being mugged in a dark alley. But, you know, how they measure the health effect of the martial arts is their Confucian officials is like, I'm 60 years old and I can drop to my knees and kowtow whenever I have to do it in court. Instantly like that, just like a young man, and no one has to help me get up. And this is phenomenal, right? Because all my other civil servant buddies, it takes them a long time to get down, a long time to get up after they're kowtowing. But because I do martial arts, right, you know, I can do my civil service duty. And so again, we have a notion of healthism, but the goals in the body that are imagined are changing through time, right?
Yeah. Okay. So there's two other things that I definitely want us to talk about. The first one is the idea of invented traditions as an academic kind of concept for how we understand these things. And the other one is the idea of the East-West binary, like there's an Eastern versus a Western, because these are things that I try to emphatically reiterate arguments about these things to my students. So I will, for instance, tell them that, according to, say, Mark Singleton, when his book is set as a chapter from his book is set as reading for one of these weeks in the module,
Oxford University Press.
Yeah. So his argument is that, so if you think about your 1936 Olympics, mm-hmm. and you have, you know, Indian strongmen and yoga, and you have Chinese wushu or guoshu and tai chi, and so on and so on and so on. Different nations representing themselves in their practices. In often those representations would be a kind of mythic invention of an idea of an ancient tradition. So yoga, as is being demonstrated in that kind of context, could have been invented last month. Like it could be a choreographic display, like when we first saw Riverdance at the Eurovision Song Contest, right? And Michael Flatley brings out this troupe of like dozens and dozens of perfectly synchronized, astonishing dancers and go, yeah, that's traditional Irish dancing. And like, yeah, it is. It kind of is. But it's a very different thing that's been reconfigured specifically for a kind of Hollywood-infused, orientalized fantasy about what Irish dancing is. So on the one hand, yes, the practice is an indigenous cultural practice. Yeah, kind of. But on the other hand, it's very much a kind of public relations display. It's been invented. And they can say this is our ancient tradition. So, I mean, how do we square that? How do we square the idea that we could choreograph a kung fu routine as mm-hmm. they do at the Olympics and as they, like at the last, recent Olympics or New Year's Eve celebrations in Beijing, they make one up for it because it looks spectacular. Or they do it in Taekwondo all the time and go, this is an ancient art that's at that 2,000 years old. They go, no, it's not. You just made this up now. How do we square the history with the invented tradition? Like there is a historical narrative and then it gets reinvented. How would you explain the idea of invented tradition to my students? How are you going to explain it?
Oh, well, I suppose it all depends whether we want to focus today on the invented or the tradition part. Maybe the best way to start is to go back to, you know, Hobbs, Baum, and Ranger and look at their earlier distinction between custom on the one hand and invented tradition on the other hand. Right, I think that helps people get their mind wrapped around it. So it isn't all invented tradition all the way down. There are genuinely organic customs that exist in society and emerge, you know, from society. So shaking hands, you know, is a custom. It doesn't mean that we have always done it forever, right? But it's not a, you know, top-down socially engineered product. And the thing about customs is they can be quite old. You know, anthropologists are always coming up with great examples of, like, you know, weird little customs that have survived forever. But on the other hand, because there's not much social acknowledgement of them and social regulation of them, customs are actually free to change fairly frequently. So every once in a while, you find a custom that is really, really old. But, you know, other customs, you know, just kind of emerge as the environment changes and technology changes. And it's just the way people interact with society and their environment, right? Yeah. And they learn a proper way to do it, and that's a custom. And notice we're talking about the people here. It's an organic process. When you get to an invented tradition, these are top-down processes, right? They don't come from the bottom up. They don't come from the people. They come from elites who generally have a goal. And the goal is, as we were talking about before in the early 20th century, it was to manipulate how the people understood themselves or how some other group of people understood them, okay? So the inventiveness of inventor tradition starts when an elite looks at a body of custom and pulls something out of it, right? Yeah. Okay, so when we're talking about yoga, right, we're talking about, well, postural, you know, postures. We're talking about, you know, the movement and breathing from one posture to the next posture. That's not everything that is in yoga. That's not most of what yoga was, and it certainly wasn't all of, you know, Indian physical culture, right? So, I mean, my favorite thing about the history of yoga in the West is actually because I did a lot of research on occult groups and, like, you know, occultism as a reaction to industrialization, right? So, like, Aleister Crowley and all of these guys were always telling people to do yoga in the late 19th century. And whatever it was that Uncle Al was telling you to do, it was not what you find at your local studio, right? You know, he's telling you to do really esoteric meditation and visualization practices because that was yoga. That was most of what was in Hatha yoga, right? Historically, Aleister Crowley's bizarre understanding of yoga is probably more historically accurate than our studio yoga today, right? Because again, he was looking at organic custom. Yeah. He'd actually traveled there. He knew what people were doing. Now, that elite goes in and he generally, or, you know, or she, picks out one element and discards huge, huge amounts of stuff, right? That's really, for my money, what is critical to understand about invented tradition. It is the selective remembering of one thing, but it is the forgetting of lots and lots of other things. And that forgetting is a critical process because we have to get everybody imagining that they're doing the same thing and that they have always been doing the same thing. So you have to get them to kind of forget about all the other stuff that it was that they actually did or used to do, right? Yeah. And this is often a managed process through the manipulation of literature and the media and the education system. Mm-hmm. And once you're done with that, then you project it to the rest of the world. So again, we think about the 1936 Olympics, right? And we think about Indians doing, you know, yoga, if they did in their you know, physical culture displays. And yeah, I mean, there had been postures in certain sort of yoga traditions before, but the first part of invented tradition is asking, well, what else isn't there? Right? Okay, some people had done postures and some aspects of Hatha yoga practice, but you know what most people did? They did wrestling. Wrestling was really, really popular. All right, so do we see any wrestling on stage? Well, no. Why not? Well, because it's not a very elite thing. It's a kind of like dirty, in the mud kind of a thing. Plus, everyone in the world does wrestling. It's not very distinctive, right? So maybe if you're trying to showcase what is special and unique about Indian culture, you don't start with wrestling, okay? All right. what else don't we see? We don't see any dance. We don't see any music. I mean, dance and music were core components of traditional Indian physical culture, right? That's all kind of been done away with in yoga. It's very clearly split off from that. Well, why aren't we going to put like dance on stage? Because dance is kind of feminine. And this is the Olympics, man. And we're all trying to show that, you know, we're a manly nation that can stand among other manly nations, right? And so you get Ben Spatz's, I think, very, you know, well thought out point here about, and Mark Singleton as well, about the repeated emphasis of, you know, athleticism and masculinity in the development of yoga to kind of push it in this direction. So to begin with, we discard lots of things. We zoom in on one thing. But then that one thing that we've zoomed in on, we usually have to remake. We're not even doing the postures of Hatha Yoga like they existed back in the day. What we're doing is we're transitioning between them quickly while coordinating our breathing. And why do you do that? Well, again, the 1936 Olympics are a great place to look because you will have Swedish gymnastics and Finnish gymnastics and like German gymnastics. And what do we see? People holding athletic postures and then transitioning from one to the next with a certain number of breaths in between them. Yeah. So if you're Indian, you want to say, hey, look, we have our own unique postures and we can do it just like you guys can do it over there. Right. And at that point, we now have a full-blown invented tradition, right? You know, yeah, something has been plucked from the past, but it has been fundamentally transformed to kind of fit the goals of elites. We're not in the realm of custom anymore. You know, we're in the realm of we're going to create the nation and we're going to craft all you people so you're subjects of the nation. And then we're going to sell it to those guys over there. And, you know, again, what do I want to focus on? If I want to focus on the tradition bit, I can find areas of continuity, right? I certainly can. And if I want to focus on, you know, the invented bit, I think I can find even more, you know, in terms of not even just the transformation, but man, the timing of the transformation. You look at the timing of when all of this happened, and it's just like, yeah, that's really revealing.
Yeah. And one thing that really I found really interesting in Mark Singleton's discussion of yoga is the thing in yoga still, I mean, when I learned it and talked to people about it, it's like everyone knows you hold a posture for 8 breaths and then you move on, right? And there's lots of different rationalizations for that. And Singleton says, well, it's probably more because that's about the amount of time it takes for the person talking through the demonstration to explain how you get into the posture and what to look for and how to relax. And so the person demonstrating, they breathe for 8 and then they move into the next and so on and so on. But, and I get that. That's interesting that a tradition could emerge, and we can give it all sorts of esoteric meanings. Like it takes you that long before you find your center, and it takes you that long before the muscles can, and all this stuff, but it might just be a convenient amount of time. And I was wondering whether you saw any connection between certain kinds of capture technologies like photography. I mean, there's an argument that the emergence of bodybuilding as a thing that I like here's my biceps kind of thing, mm-hmm. is intimately connected with the proliferation of photography. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the logic of bodybuilding, it's very much a static, like snap, 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 you know, like take the photo. It's not a cinematic thing like Kung Fu or dance. Mm-hmm. It's and also with bodybuilding, you can only exist in that state of like vascularity and leanness for like a few days. You know that. So it's very much a kind of static, snap, frozen in time, abstracted, impossible. It's you know, the photograph has that duration. Like you put the photograph on the wall, and it's like, my God, Arnold Schwarzenegger always looks like this, when it's a lie. But it's so therefore the media technology is what produced the embodied practice. And I'm wondering if you go back to the kind of 1930s nationalist, you know, mass displays of this is our nation, if there's a connection with, you know, photography, basically, do you think? Or
yeah, Well, and the really interesting thing about the 1930s is the mass display of our nation, right? So you have finally got really good film with sound in it, cheap, and networks where you can move it around the world and everybody can see your newsreel, right? Yeah. And so you can have those mass rallies wherever it is that you happen to be, you know, building your nation, right? And that, you know, it fits so well with the somatic aspect of community building. Like, if you're trying to convince people that they, you know, are Chinese, and so by doing kung fu, they're Japanese by doing kendo, they're Indian by doing yoga, right? You know, what happens is you do yoga and you have certain somatic experiences and you feel it in your body. And it's like, this is what